Hi, everybody. This is Armand Demel.
And this is Roberta Maria Atti.
And we're here with you with the Positive Mind, WBAI 99.5 FM, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. And today, a very exciting thing that grew out of a conversation that I was having with a few people about the thermal wars. Thermal wars. What an interesting concept. Now, this comes out of a conversation with Neil Schachter, who is a physician up at Mount Sinai. And we were talking about adaptation. We were talking about the difference between people. And it started off just very simply talking about the difference between people and the way they sense temperature. Now, this is going to lead us into a very fascinating conversation, but let's just look at how people are different when it comes to temperature. You know, you could be somebody who, if you have diabetes, for example, and you tend to have cold feet, you might have a chill more than other people. Or if you're somebody who is thin-skinned, thin, let's say you don't have much fat on your body, and of a low metabolism, you could be somebody who gets cold all the time. Or if you're somebody who's very heavy and you have a lot of weight on your body, you could be somebody who's hot all the time. There are many things that affect your sense of temperature. From this description of your sense of temperature and what affects your sense of temperature, we're going to move into a very fascinating discussion about adaptation, accommodation, and human relationships. Let's start off with temperature, Roberta. How do people experience temperature differently?
Sure. Well, first of all, we could start by saying that men and women are very different when it comes to thermoregulation.
Men and women are different.
Men and women are different, Armand. Yes, they are. Very different. Women tend to be slightly warmer. They have a higher body temperature, and so that could be one of the reasons why women have a tendency to feel colder generally than men do.
Because you have a higher body temperature,
yep.
You feel colder?
Yes.
Oh.
Yes, because in comparison with the outside temperature, your body is warmer, therefore you feel the cold more.
Okay.
Another reason is that because of menstruation, women lose blood every month, and so then that lowers their overall causes them to feel the cold more. Another reason is that women seem to suffer from hypothyroidism more often than men, much more often than men. And that's a condition whereby actually one of the symptoms is low temperature. And women are told to take their temperature as soon as they wake up in the morning, and from that they can determine how their thyroid is working.
But I thought you said if you have a higher temperature, you feel colder.
The inside of the body is warmer in women. The core temperature is warmer. That does not mean the peripheral temperature. Now, since we're talking about the core, let me get right to it. The one time when women feel really hot, of course, is after menopause, perimenopause and postmenopause. And this has been traditionally attributed to a lowering of estrogen a lowering of the production of estrogen in the woman, and so it has been treated by giving the woman hormones.
And let me understand first. There are two different parts before we go into that. One part is that women have their what I've understood about women, that they could either have around the time of premenstrually, not premenopausal, some women have raise in temperature and others have lower in temperature. Some women have this thing where they get cold and hot.
Right.
And that thing happens. And then what happens is you say around perimenopausal and menopausal time and postmenopausal, we have this thing called hot flashes. Now, hot flashes are a very interesting thing because there seems to be a thermal regulator. Forget about, there are theories about the causes, right? Theories about hormones and so on and so forth that have been refuted. But the one thing we know is this. A woman is feeling like all of a sudden she's just, you know, walking through her day and some kind of a switch goes off that's a little like a fire alarm. And suddenly the sprinklers go off and all outpours this sweat and this heat floods her face, her neck, her chest, and her peripheral vessels. And she feels this intense heat.
It's mostly upper body, actually.
Upper body
intensity. From the chest up.
And it's you're gasping for coolness.
It's called heat dissipation, and it's a strategy that the body adopts when the temperature is too high internally. And by doing that, a hot flash, even though it feels so hot, but it's actually a way to lose heat.
Right.
Because it dilates all the vessels. And it releases heat through that vessel dilation and through sweating.
And it's not that the body is so hot that it needs to release it. It's a switch that goes off.
Right.
That goes off in the hypothalamus that says it's as if your body was this hot. It's as if your body was hot, not that your body is hot.
Well, yes, that's well
said. It's not like you have a fever.
No.
And you know you have an intense fever.
It's
and you've
got to
get rid of the heat.
It's a dysregulation of the thermal system. It's a dysregulation in the sense that, as Armand is saying, nothing's wrong. It's not like there's a fever or there's excessive heat, even though that's what it feels like. What is going on is that the hypothalamus, which is a structure inside the brain, regulates the temperature in the body. And when in a woman there is even a minor dysfunction in the hypothalamus, so that the temperature regulation is overall disrupted, even a little bit, even a tiny little bit, a minute difference in the temperature in the environment, even a tenth of a degree, can trigger that switch that Armand is talking about. And once that switch has been switched on, then you have this flash of heat that comes up to the face and it is released. It really feels like a flame that women describe it as if they were going up in smoke almost.
You know, very, very, very difficult.
But it doesn't last very long. It lasts for a couple of minutes, and then it goes away. But actually, it seems that even though all women at menopause have a decrease in the levels of estrogen, not all women have this symptom.
Right.
So that's why it's not just related to the estrogen decrease, but it's also related to the hypothalamic dysfunction.
So what we bring it to, or actually hypothalamic function.
Yeah, function. It's
function.
It's not really a dysfunction.
Dysfunction.
It's a way to release heat, just like a pressure cooker releases pressure through the valve.
Mm-hmm. And it's nature's way.
Right.
Nature's way of saying something.
Exactly. That's one thing that Armand and I would like really to point out, that nothing's wrong with hot flashes. It's not a symptom that a woman is unhealthy or sick or that anything is wrong with her. It's just a sign that her body is regulating the temperature.
Now, the interesting thing about hot flashes and about this kind of stuff is, again, this is where the conversation came up, because a group of men were discussing this and they were talking about what it's like to live with it. Because the men on the other side live with having to live with the cold room that is being commanded. You see, when you're
demanded
in it,
and
well,
commanded.
Demanded, sure, because the way that it's recommended that you live with hot flashes, as they say, wear layers of clothing, and then when you have the hot flash, take off the layers of clothing.
Mm-hmm.
You see, and if you take off the layers of clothing, that's how you cool out. But most people can't imagine wearing layers of clothing when they have hot flashes.
Mm-hmm.
So what they want to do is cool down the room. And what most people will do at the peak of the hot flashes, they will have the room down to about 45 degrees. And they will try to sleep in that and then cover themselves and then uncover themselves when the flash hits, and then cover themselves again. But now, what do you do when you're somebody who lives with this? And this is what leads us into today's subject, which is about accommodation. You see, love and relationships have been, through the beginning of human existence, been about accommodation. How do you accommodate to the different needs, heat-wise, and so many other ways? Like, let's look at some of the other heat variations besides hot flashes. What are some of the other heat variations that people have?
What do you mean heat variations?
The other thermal things that go on.
Well, you mean in terms of symptoms of thyroid dysfunction, things like that?
Yeah, sure.
Well, when the thyroid is underactive, for instance, the body cannot seem to warm up, and it's almost, it's really as if it feels as if the furnace was not working, and that no matter what you do, even if you bury yourself in blankets, you can't warm up. Now, the opposite of that is when you have a fever, when the body's attempting to burn off toxins. That's what a fever is, by the way. When the immune system decides that there is maybe too high a count of a certain bacteria in the lungs or somewhere. By the way, Armand, did you know that you cannot have a viral pneumonia? You can only have bacteria in the lungs? Well, anyway. So when there is an infection and the count of bacteria is too high, the body will raise its temperature literally to burn off the bacteria and the waste that they produce. Anytime there's food poisoning and toxins are released inside the blood, the body will raise the temperature to burn off toxins. So actually the fever symptom, unless it goes beyond 103, is actually not a good idea to suppress, because it's doing what the body needs to do. Now, other things with,
well, you know, the other thing I wanted to ask you about, Roberta, is there are some people who are naturally warmer, whose metabolism is different than others, right? Let's
right.
say you live with somebody, and you have a very high metabolism.
Right.
Now, high metabolism means you burn food, and you burn it fuel-wise, and you produce heat.
Yes, metabolism is the way in which we take nutrients and extract energy in the form of heat from them. So to have a high metabolism means to burn everything you eat.
So there are some people who are very warm all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some people who are very cool all the time.
But you see, if it goes overboard, Armand, if it becomes too high, as in hyperthyroidism.
Well, no, I'm just saying somewhere in the high range of normal.
Okay, in the high range of normal, that person is the kind of person who can go outside in a winter storm wearing a t-shirt.
Right.
And they feel just fine.
Now, you see, what will happen is vacation time comes. And one will say, let's go down to the Caribbean, because they want to be warm.
Mm-hmm.
And the other will say, let's go skiing.
Right.
You see, and they think that this is about, oh, well, this is prettier than this, and I like this better than that, and you want to just lay around, and I want to do something active. But the very fact that you want activity is about burning energy.
Yep.
And the very fact that you want to lay around is about reducing energy.
Right.
And the very fact that you want to bask in the sun is about absorbing heat. And the very fact that you want to be in the cold is about dissipating heat.
Yep.
And here you think you're taking vacation choices just because you got your rewards program from your mileage. You know, and it really is, all of the choices you make are adaptations. Many of them are thermal adaptations.
Yes.
And so you don't know that you're being dictated by things that are going on inside your body.
Not only that, Armand, I was reading about some studies that were done by a Danish doctor, which I can find his name in just a moment, whereby he studied how people function in a work environment based on temperature regulation.
Beautiful study. Good. Tell us about that.
Well, what he found was that people, the productivity goes up like 70% when people have control over the temperature of the environment in which they work. If they cannot control the temperature and the temperature somehow is not right for them, their productivity drops to, you know, very, very low levels. So temperature regulation, even in schools, children who are taking a test will perform 15% higher if the temperature is around 70 degrees. When the temperature was raised to 78 degrees, performance in the test went down 15%. So all of this really tells us that temperature regulation is extremely important for comfort, but also that there is no such thing as a standard temperature that is okay for everyone.
There is a way of regulating nowadays, but through thermostats, you can regulate most of the heat. You can't regulate the air because you can't get fresh air into a place too easily, you know, but you can regulate conditioned air into a room to get it just to the perfect degree that the person would like and they would function at, and you could increase productivity by 70%.
But that's what these architects are doing. They're figuring out
absolutely.
A way to give the workers control over the temperature and also to bring in fresh air. The combination
of
two is just amazing.
Tell me about regulating your temperature when you're trying to get pregnant. What is that about, trying to take your temperature? Because I know it's just a matter of like 1 or 2 degrees, right?
Yeah.
What is that about? How do you get pregnant by regulating?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's you first are supposed to take your temperature every day for a few months and to chart the variations in temperature.
By what? By a point?
Yeah,
five?
You have to have a very sensitive thermometer because you have to monitor the slight variations that indicate that you are about to ovulate. When you ovulate, your temperature goes up by a fraction of a degree, and yet, or sometimes up to a degree, but even a slight increase like that, especially around the middle of the month, the middle of the cycle, signals ovulation. So if you want to get pregnant, that would be a good time to try to conceive. And a lot of women use that method because it's relatively effective and safe in the sense that they don't have to take hormones and do anything that could be counterproductive in the long
pregnant.
Run.
Isn't it, therefore, when a woman is most responsive?
Well, it can also be used
most receptive?
As a contraceptive, of course.
But
indicates ovulation can also be used in reverse to prevent pregnancy.
So it's also when she's more willing to have sex, when she feels more desire?
Of course, yes.
So
when
therefore,
the temperature goes up.
If they have a way of wearing a band around your wrist?
What do you mean?
If you wear a band around your wrist, it takes your temperature. You can now tell people, like, you know,
I'm ready.
I'm ready. Like, the thing we gave up. Right? Because one of the things that humans gave up was this, the thing about hiding when they were ready.
Right. Yeah. Right. We would go back in evolution, perhaps.
Go back and say, only now. Not late. Not now.
And then the men would say, okay, no more meat for you.
I have a headache. All right, this is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti. We're talking about thermal stuff, and we're talking about it because we're leading to a key feature about relationships. You have to understand that there is a thing about relationships. There is a reason why menopause happens. And a reason why menopause happens and this heat happens is in relationships. When you get to that point of your relationship, you know whether you want to be in that relationship or not, because this is when you accommodate. This is when your love and your relationship tells you, all right, all right, I got to take care of this person. I got to be with this person. This person needs this. It's going to be uncomfortable for me. And every man I've ever met who's in a relationship who talks about having gone through that stuff about the heat talks about having gone through it. They don't talk about how, you know, they say, oh, it's a horrible time, but they go through it. They understand it's necessary. Let's talk about all the different accommodations that people have to go through with each other, men and women, in order to maintain a relationship with each other. You don't think there are as many as there really are.
Well, people who don't do well in accommodating generally live alone, because any time you live with someone, you're going to have to accommodate something, whether it's space, time, smell, television, or, you know, whatever. There's
Let's
always
take them
some,
one at a time.
Some negotiation that goes on. But there was something I wanted to say, Armand, about territory, that when we are in a relationship with someone and we share a territory, as you say, we accommodate in different ways. When a stranger enters a territory, our body reacts very differently. We don't accommodate. We have all sorts of physical reactions to someone being in our space if we don't want them there. So even the body, not just what we are willing to do, but the biological response to someone we love inhabiting the space we're in is very different from the physiological response to sharing a space with someone we don't know, even beyond what we're willing or not willing to do.
Let's think about, and I want to ask you people to send me an email as a survey to armand@thepositivemind.com, the different accommodations that you think people have to make to each other, and, you know, the kind of things that they have to go through, that every couple has to go through, and not only couples, but families, and not only families, but people at work. Now, just to give you an example of it, let's talk about noise levels. Noise levels. Now, one would think, again, you know, when it comes to temperature, people say 72 degrees, that's normal. But if you have a body temperature that's lower than normal, 72 is not going to be right for you. And if you're going to have a body temperature that's higher than normal, 72 is not right for you. So you need something a little different. And here is where the adaptation comes in, the accommodation with the people who you're with. Let's talk about noise levels. Do you know the difference in sensitivity between people and noise levels? Some people love things to be loud and noisy, that these things are loud. And I say noisy, I don't mean it as a judgment. I mean they like loud. They like loud television, loud movies. Kids, you know, teenagers. If you ever go into a teenager's room when they're playing video games or they're watching TV, It's amazing. If you go to a video arcade, it's amazing. It sounds like cacophony to an average adult. Now, that's one level of noise, because they want to be swallowed by the sound. Usually the teenager says, I get completely engrossed in the thing itself. And the louder the sound, the more engrossed I get. But if you're somebody who's off on the side, that sound could be invasive. And, or if you're somebody whose ears have a thinner tympanic membrane, you could actually feel it as hurt. Or if you're somebody who's trying to do something else, like think or write, the sound could bother you. Who's wrong? What's the right thing to do? Well, one would say you should accommodate it, and the one with the loud TV should do something. Well, why isn't it that the one with the sensitive ears doesn't put on a pair of headphones? Or use earplugs? Why does only one accommodate? You see, there are so many different ways. In fact, Bose, B-O-S-E, has just made a set of headphones that have a white noise on them. That's
This concludes this 1010 WINS test of the emergency alert system.
Hi, I'm the little old lady who owned your Acura before you did. It's great. When you don't know how to get somewhere, a nice man on the dashboard tells you.
Acura certified pre-owned cars have a 7-year, 100,000-mile limited powertrain warranty. They're so pristine, you'll think the previous owner was a little old lady. For a limited time, you can get APR financing as low as 2.9% on all certified pre-owned Acura MDX and TL models. See dealer for financing.
Conducting a test, and I'm going to keep talking. So we're talking about adjusting to people in relationships, adjusting to different levels of heat and cold, different levels of noise, different levels of sound tests.
Sound tests. You know, we were just talking about sound, and they had to do a test. A sound test. It was magic.
A sound test
in case we get attacked by
the meanies.
By the meanies.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, of course. So noise levels are a very big thing to deal with. Other things you have to deal with that are very funny, because again, it's appreciating the fact that when you are with people, they are different than you. And that even though there's a standard of people, like people's sense of noise is different, people's sense of sound is different, people's sense of brightness is different. What hurts somebody's eyes, what may be bright to one person, is dark to another. Some people like to fill a room with light. Other people like it to be dark. Some people can't sleep if there's an ounce of light in the room. Other people, it doesn't matter. They can't sleep without a light on. So different sensitivities to light become something that people have to adapt to. And it's a funny thing trying to learn how do you do it. And, you know, the funny thing that happens with couples is they do it. They do get to the point where they adapt, where the person who could never sleep with a light on eventually sleeps with a light on.
That's what I was going to say, Armand, that it seems to me that if people are willing to make accommodations, eventually the accommodation becomes the norm, even for the one who has had to accommodate. But if I think it's more difficult for people who are so used to being alone,
you're so right,
and in control of their space and everything in it, that the longer a person lives alone, I think the more difficult it is to accommodate to someone else's wishes.
That's why having children is one of the big signs that you know how to accommodate.
Definitely.
Do you know what I mean? I mean, you can have children and not know how to accommodate.
Oh, well,
you just
definitely
can't. Otherwise, you wind up killing your kids. You know what I mean?
There's a lot of accommodating there, for sure. Yes, but even in marriages or you know, partnerships, I think that,
and working environments,
even
Roberta,
when you get along with someone and this is your soulmate and everything is absolutely the way it should be, there's going to be something where both partners have to accommodate to the other's needs.
And this is Armand DeMille and Roberta Mariotti. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll play a little music and we'll be continuing.
También, si no vacilo, se come también que para gozar. Iriribum, 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 iriribum. Iriribum, 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 iriribum.
come también, si no vacilo, se come también, que para gozar, hiriribum, hiriribum.
Armand DeMille, Roberta Maria Atti. We are talking about adaptations, accommodation, and the thermal wars. You know, there are some painstaking differences between people when it comes to pain itself. And there are some gender differences which we've talked about when it comes to pain.
Well, we're going to pain because there's also something to be said for the way different people experience pain and different levels of the threshold of pain and how different people can relate to pain, so that someone could sit there with a toothache and not complain for a week, and someone else, you know, they could have a paper cut and scream their head off for a half hour.
Sometimes you could look at somebody who you care about, you know, Roberta, and if they are hurt, if something is hurt in them, or if they're cut, and you're squeamish about pain, or if you have a low pain threshold, you could feel the pain that they don't feel.
Yeah, that happens too.
You know, it happens.
Yep,
sometimes,
sure.
I mean, like one time I was doing my do-it-yourself root canal kit.
Oh.
And I remember one of my friends was saying, you can't do your own root canal.
You were taking out a nerve from your own
tooth? I was just,
tooth?
Doing my, I'm only kidding.
Armand, you got me there for
a
moment. Well, yes, because you are capable of anything. And for a moment I thought, my goodness, he probably did it.
Do it yourself, root canal.
My goodness, Armand. You got me on air. God knows how many people are listening. And there I am saying, really?
Really?
Really? Really? Oh, my God. Anyway, pain. Okay, let's forget about that moment
of
deep embarrassment. Nociceptor. Noci, like noci, is the root that means suffering, pain, from Latin. And Nociceptors are the little receptors that are in charge of perceiving pain and sending out messages to the brain that, uh-oh, something's happening that should not be happening. And the interesting thing is, you know, when we go on in, when we're in surgery and we think that just because we are under anesthesia, we don't feel the pain, guess what? We're not aware of feeling it, but the body's feeling it. The moment the surgeon's knife makes that first incision, the little nociceptors go to work and start secreting this stuff, these chemicals that immediately go to the brain and tell the brain that a lot of pain is going on and it's going to get worse before it gets better. And the pain immediately starts to bathe the nervous system in glutamate, which is the neurotransmitter that is designed to impress a memory. So the brain says something really bad is happening and we want to remember this so that we don't allow it to happen ever again. So now when you wake up, you're in pain, not in pain because you're in pain in that moment. In that moment, nothing's happening. You're half asleep and, you know, you probably have a nurse bathing you or feeding you or something. But you feel that pain because now you're feeling it. It's like a delayed experience of the pain you felt while you were under anesthesia. It's memory pain. And it's what your body is trying to do to protect you from experiencing it again.
As if it happened by accident, because the body doesn't know from surgery.
Exactly.
The body doesn't know about, you know, people doing operations on you. Your body only knows about walking in the savannah and getting pierced by somebody's tooth.
Tooth? I thought you were going to say arrow, but somebody's tooth, that's a lot more.
I was thinking before
more.
Then, you know. Before
right,
the arrow.
You were going to the source. Okay.
But no, really, now this is fascinating because if the body doesn't know that if the anesthetic only works at blocking the perception of the pain, not the pain itself.
Exactly. The pain is still going on.
Then that is why when you have a minor surgery, like somebody pulls a tooth and they give you this anesthesia, you may need a full day to recover even though you didn't feel anything.
Exactly. Because you actually did feel it. You just were not aware of it.
In fact, because the pain was blocked, you may feel it worse.
Exactly. Yes.
You might have been better off.
Well, I don't know about that. I personally would rather be anesthetized for any kind of dental work. But the thing is that the body...
You know, I tested that, Roberta. I tested that with a couple of times with dental work.
What do you
and
mean
I
you
found
tested?
Without... Well, without... Without the anesthesia, I did far better than with the anesthesia.
But see, then
white,
let's talk about pain threshold. Let's talk about that for a
but
moment.
But I have a high pain threshold.
Well, yes, you do.
I do.
Incredibly so. I know that because I've known you through the years to be able to withstand things that other people couldn't withstand. But most people really could not have a drill in their teeth and sit there and not jump. And see, the danger is that even though you may be willing to brave it out, your body reacts independent of your own will, so that the dentist could go with the drill a little bit deeper and you could jump, leap off the chair.
Sure, and create
damage. And create damage, you know, they you could drill your eyes out or something. So that's one of the reasons why dentists recommend that you do get anesthesia. But there's been a long debate whether men or women have a more tolerance for pain. And it seems like a ping pong game of science. One of those where it goes, no more men, no more women, no more men, no more women. And a lot of studies are coming up on both sides of the argument. Generally speaking, it seems that women are better able to tolerate long-term pain. So pain that comes on. But women don't do very well with sudden pain, so the woman will react much more strongly, immediately, and negatively to a sudden hurt. she may jump or scream or cry when she gets hurt, much more so than a man does. The man does much better with the short-term acute pain, and woman does much better with the long-term chronic pain, generally speaking. And I think there's a reason for that. Biologically, women are designed to bear children, which is a slowly increasing level of pain that goes up and up and up and up and up very slowly, and it's not sudden and it's not acute until the very end of the labor when the child comes out. There's that moment of acute pain, but generally the labor is this kind of pain that comes on slowly. Men are designed to withstand the pain related with hunting, which is the kind of thing that is acute, intense, and doesn't last as long as, you know, labor and delivery.
Yeah, and labor intensive, like they may have to lift, you know, a gorilla or an elephant for a minute, and they suffer the pain of it for now, but then they put it down.
I don't know where you get your images, Armand, but you have a very interesting collection of examples there with visuals to match that you seem to be able to gift us with. I very much appreciate the lifting of the gorilla. I had never heard before.
Lifting the gorilla very before painful. You do root canal.
Before you do root canal, not while you do root canal. Don't attempt to lift a gorilla while you do your own root canal. How did we get here, Armand?
All right, now wait.
Accommodation.
Is all pain nerve pain?
What do you mean is all? Yes, it is. Well, there's emotional pain, but ultimately all pain is felt.
What do you call a pain in the butt? Okay, no.
Hemorrhoids.
Right. Is all pain nerve pain, or is all pain? Is there such a thing as muscle pain?
It's all nerve pain. Only the nervous system can feel pain.
It's only the nervous system.
Yep, no other tissue in the body feels pain.
Do you know that there is no pain in the lungs?
There's no pain in the brain.
Yeah, in the lungs and in the brain.
Yeah, you could have someone mess with your brain while you're awake, assuming that you could stay alive, and you would feel nothing.
That's Hannibal Lecter,
yeah, right? That movie, right.
Right. No pain whatsoever in the lungs. So if you have things going wrong inside your lungs, there's no pain receptors there.
Right, and even in the nerve, in the digestive system, for instance, in the intestines, there's only one kind of pain receptors, and it's related to pressure. So that people feel pain, let's say, of gas or constipation, because there's a pressure that is registered as pain. But pain, let's say that you would get your gut cut by a knife, you would not feel that because it wouldn't be pressure. It's a different kind of pain. So we have different kinds of pain receptors, and they're only designed to feel that kind of pain, not all kinds of pain.
Now, how does this, the difference in the pain thresholds, apply to the accommodation principle that we're talking about?
Well, it certainly does. It does in the sense that, for instance, things that could be painful to one person and not to another, like loud music, like too much light in the eyes. I mean, that's obvious that there are certain things like that that could be really uncomfortable for someone. And so we have to accommodate to that if we want to live with them. But also, I think people tend to minimize other people's pain if they're someone who is not as sensitive to pain, so that someone could be crying and moaning and complaining and expressing a lot of distress over a minor injury, like a child does, let's say, and we could feel very annoyed and impatient with them, thinking that they're making a big deal out of nothing. But for that person, that small injury could really be very traumatic, and they could be really in distress and about to pass out over it. Some people will faint at the sight of blood.
You know, I mean, we accommodate our infants' teething pain. You know, we look at it. And
well, that's got to be horrendous.
Isn't that got to be a thing?
Yeah, it's got to be horrendous because when children are teasing, they are. You have to imagine the tooth that's pulling through the gum, piercing the gum, and at first it itches like crazy, and children want to bite everything inside to scratch that itch. But then when it finally comes through, it hurts just like anything that would come through any skin. And it's really painful, and they have tearing of the eyes and lots of liquid that comes out of the nose, and it's really very painful.
So if only we had that kind of affection for the people around us who are experiencing pain, no matter what the pain. Well, if it's emotional pain, we tend not to want...
Oh, yeah, we
dismiss
it, sure.
You know what I mean? We tend to want to dismiss it.
Especially when people tend to have chronic pain, so that they are in pain a lot and very often, and there is a lot of constant complaining and crying and, you know, being upset over pain. After a while, we tend to get kind of fed up with it and like, well, get over it already. But it's not that simple. Grief is one of them. When people have been in grief for a long time and they can't seem to get out of it, we tend to be impatient with it, and we tend to tell them, well, isn't it time you should get over it? Well, you know, maybe they can't get over it.
The time that it gets most difficult when it's emotional pain that a person is in is when they lean, because you're the person who's present with them, when they lean it on you, when they say, it's your fault that I'm in this pain.
Hmm.
That's where you become intolerant. See, where my pain is your fault, where it's, you know, it clearly is their own pain, and it's when it gets turned against you, you tend to stop accommodating.
Hmm.
Then you start looking to see how you get out of the situation. One of our one of our listeners talked about scents around the house, a scent, S-C-E-N-T. One of the things I was reading recently about perfume is about the science of perfume, about the microbes, about the tiny size of things, molecules, and they, when you spray a perfume or even an air freshener,
mm-hmm.
and how for some people it is totally invasive and almost an allergen.
Yeah.
And that some people have this allergic response to smells.
Incense can be very
It could be
distressing
totally
for some
irritating,
people.
Especially mm-hmm. with people who've got any kind of lung disease.
Yeah.
You know, and other people won't understand it. They'll just say, no, you know, it's just an air freshener.
Mm-hmm.
I get in a taxi cab every now and then, and they've used these.
So yeah.
Have you ever seen these
yeah.
air fresheners?
Oh, my goodness,
that
yes.
they use? I don't know what they're covering up. So somehow it's another one of the things that they have to do.
But even perfume can be so invasive that it can be really painful sometimes to be in an elevator with someone who is wearing a heavy perfume or some kind of heavy, you know, deodorant.
And to other people, it's not.
And to
other
people,
people
it's not.
It's not.
Sure.
You could
sure.
you could welcome it. Now, here's one of our listeners who said, you know, I was accommodating my whole life, Helen says, and now I'm living alone and I don't accommodate anybody and I love it.
You know who I make a lot of accommodations for? My puppies.
Yeah, you accommodate them.
Yeah, I accommodate my puppies, and I think people tend to accommodate their pets a lot, if you love them, of course. You tend to make accommodations for pets sometimes that you don't make for people. You know?
One of the smart guys, Jim, says, not only do I live alone, but when I worked, I negotiated working from 8 p.m. to 6 a.m., so that I was the only one in the office at the time. I don't accommodate anybody.
Yeah, some people find it very
difficult.
That's
the only way to do it. But, you know, we have to go back to the beginning.
Okay.
Sperm and eggs.
Right.
Right? It's on every menu.
In every diner in New York.
In every diner in New York. Hey, I'm taking a lot of scramble. It starts there.
Right.
You know, I mean, here comes this sperm struggling along, fighting off 200 million other sperm, finally gets up this channel.
It's got to be a marathon.
Right?
Huh?
It's some struggle, you know? One out of 200 million gets up there, or stepping over all the other dead bodies,
mm-hmm.
finally knocks on the door. The egg says, hey,
oh.
I've been waiting. Come on in.
Come on in, right.
Handsome.
Come on in, handsome.
Come on in, handsome. Close the door behind you.
Yeah, make sure.
Right, make sure the door is shut.
Don't let them in.
Don't let any more in. And then you shut the door. And then the first thing she does is look at you and she says, I'd like you to take off your head. Right? Because underneath the head of the sperm is all of this stuff that she needs, right? Mm-hmm.
Well, it's good manners to take off your head if you're a sperm inside an egg.
Because what happens under the head? It's not the head, it's the top of the head.
Yeah, it's the membrane that contains the genetic information that the sperm is delivering to the egg so that the two of them can intermingle and make a third, which is not going to be either one of them. See, that's what's interesting, that here is the ultimate accommodation. The two of them, the egg and the sperm, sacrifice their lives completely, because they're never going to be an egg or a sperm again, in order to make this one cell that doesn't look at all like either one of them. Well, it looks a little bit like the egg, but, you know, it's a different thing. And now this cell is going to split itself up and become two cells, and then those two are going to become four, and then eight, and then 16. And a little bit later, there is a human being there.
So in order to create, the ultimate accommodation starts at the very beginning. And
yes.
So the egg and the sperm immediately start sacrificing,
yes,
and giving up parts of self to accommodate, to say, we know we have to do this. Right. We know we have to go through, you know, this meiotic process.
Yes, I wouldn't be able to fulfill my purpose without you. Therefore, I am willing to give up my self. Integrity as
the
self.
The integrity of myself,
mm-hmm.
Right?
In order to accommodate you.
So that we could create an entity that will be greater than us.
Yes.
It starts there, you know, and if you're lucky, it goes on there,
mm-hmm.
somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Not that it just ends in a single relationship, but if you're really lucky, it continues on to your relationship with the entire universe,
sure.
And all the people around you and the people you work with and your family.
Sure. I think in the end it has to do with really accommodating life and all of its unpredictable demands and, you know, things that we may not understand in the moment, but in the long run, we grow.
This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti. Roberta, I tasted your nut milk. It's fabulous.
Oh, thank you, Armand. I'm so proud of it.
You know,
thank you.
You could reach Roberta Maria Atti at
www.creativehealthsolutions, with an S at the end, .org.
And you can send me an email on armand@brainlink.com or go to the WBAI.org, and you can hear a replay of today's program. My friends, I'll be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m.